Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. Our program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Every day, we bring you news and information about America and the world. This is what you will hear on our program. Listen for Science in the News about a famous zoo animal in the U.S. Then, our American History program, Making of a Nation. But first, this report about education in America.
American high school students might have a big change in their world history education next year. The College Board announced in May that it plans to limit the amount of material covered in its Advanced Placement, or AP, World History exam. It wants the exam to test students on their knowledge of the past 560 years or so, from the year 1450 to the present. This means students would not be tested on people, places, and events before that period. They would not need to know about the Roman Empire, ancient Egyptian and Chinese history, or the Incan and Aztec civilizations before the arrival of European explorers. The College Board's proposal has received strong criticism from teachers across the United States. Some feel the move would increase the influence of Western Europe in AP World History classes. They say this also would reduce the amount of time they spend teaching about other cultures.
The College Board is an independent organization that supports the growth of U.S. higher education. The not-for-profit group directs the AP program and AP exams in U.S. high schools. Schools pay the College Board to use its AP teaching program and tests. The material chosen for the exams influences what subjects are included in the classes. Jasley Carroll, a spokesperson for the College Board, said its leadership proposed the changes because the AP World History class covers too much information. The College Board suggests spreading the material over two classes, as many U.S. colleges do. Carroll said, "Our intention is spreading the content of AP World History over two courses is to ensure that such important content is given the time it deserves. In doing this, we are following the same model that colleges use and that we have used for most other AP courses, whether in science, English, mathematics, world languages, or the arts, providing students with a foundational year of content prior to the AP year." Trevor Packer, the head of College Board's AP program, told the New York Times the plan was based, in part, on comments from history teachers. He noted that some said they struggled to teach almost 100 centuries of material in just 1 year.
However, many teachers and educators have sharply criticized the proposal. Sarah Hannon, a former history teacher, said that she was heartbroken by the proposal and that it does a disservice to teaching history. Hannon lives in Juneau, the capital of Alaska. "I think 1450 really focuses it onto a European-dominated story. It throws us back to that arrogance of Western civilization as the focus of history," she added. Peter Stearns, a professor at George Mason University in Virginia, agrees. Stearns noted that many events taking place before 1450 are important. He said they provide students a foundation to learn about more recent history. Stearns added that while he understands the need for organizing a curriculum so that students can understand history better, it is clear that 1450 is not the right date to start with. It is important, he said, to include material about the history of non-Western societies and cultures before the time of globalization. Stearns was one of several professors who signed a letter to the College Board's Trevor Packer. The letter warned that if the class were to begin at 1450, the signers would urge their universities to stop accepting AP World History for college credit.
In June, at a meeting with Packer in Utah, many teachers protested the idea. In sometimes tense discussions, teacher Amanda Doamiral explained that schools would not have the money to pay for two AP World History classes. "They don't have the money for pencils, dude," she said. "How are they going to teach that class?" Politico reported that a new pre-AP World History class would cost anywhere from $600 to $6,500, depending on the size of the school and the number of pre-AP courses being offered. High school students have entered the debate. Dylan Black, a student from New Jersey, is leading a campaign on the website change.org. He is calling on Packer to cancel his proposal. The campaign has 11,000 signatures, well above an earlier goal of 5,000.
It appears that the College Board is listening to the criticism from American educators. In an email, Jasley Carriel said the College Board was moved by the concerns about how the changes to AP World History could affect students. "We recognize how important it is for students to study non-European cultures and civilizations prior to 1450. We will address such principled concerns in a revised approach we will share soon," she said. Last month, Packer wrote that he still believes 1 year is not enough time to teach all the material currently taught in an AP World History class. He said it is important for students to learn about historical events taking place before 1450. And he promised to look for a solution that is more agreeable to educators. In response, Stearns wrote on his blog that while some educators will still be disappointed, College Board's openness is a good sign. Stearns also said that if one of the issues is how colleges organize their history classes, then maybe professors should discuss among themselves the best way for structuring their own curriculum. I'm Phil Dierking.
And I'm Lucia Malonig.
Imagine having an animal as your teacher. How much do you think one could learn from a hippopotamus, for example? At the Cincinnati Zoo, a baby hippo named Fiona is helping to educate young people, both in the city of Cincinnati, Ohio, and across the United States. Fiona was born at the Cincinnati Zoo in January 2017. She arrived nearly 2 months early, before her body was strong. That meant her body was smaller than that of other baby hippos. Her birth weight was so low that Fiona's caregivers feared she might not survive. But thanks to special treatments and assistance from hospital workers, Fiona stayed healthy. Her story gained national attention because of stories on traditional and social media. The young hippo is now a symbol for the Cincinnati Zoo. The zoo has used her name and image to sell a great deal of merchandise, including clothing and toys. She is also the star of at least 6 books, and she is a very popular subject for library and classroom activities. The latest book is called Saving Fiona, which the zoo's director wrote. "She has taught us a lot," director Thane Maynard told the Associated Press. Some experts believe Fiona is the smallest hippo ever to survive. She weighed only 13 kilograms at birth. That is 1/3 the size of a normal, fully developed baby Nile hippopotamus. She was also unable to stand or take milk from her mother. A Cincinnati Zoo worker collected milk from Fiona's mother, Bibi, by hand. And the Smithsonian Institution's National Zoo in Washington, D.C., helped develop a highly nutritional food product for her. Workers from Cincinnati Children's Hospital were asked to help inject nutrients directly into her bloodstream. Maynard notes that everyone was worried about Fiona during the first 6 months of her life. But by her first birthday, she had grown to 318 kilograms, a healthy weight for a hippopotamus that age. Maynard's book is aimed at young readers, telling them the story of Fiona's struggle to survive, while also teaching them about hippos. It includes many facts about the animals, such as the fact that adult hippos only eat plants, but can run faster than people. The book also notes adult hippos can be dangerous because of their size, weighing up to 2,270 kilograms. Part of the zoo's mission is public education, Maynard said. The book is reaching kids and families with a message of hope, never giving up. To date, all the books about Fiona, when combined, have sold tens of thousands of copies. Educators say lessons with stories involving animals appeal to students. Fiona has been on the cover of 3 Scholastic News magazines. Those magazines have reached millions of students. And the stories about Fiona came with reading exercises or mathematics problems, such as finding how many bathtubs the water in her zoo would fill. Stephanie Smith is executive director for Scholastic News for students in grades 3 through 6. She says youngsters love Fiona's story. "Kids will just gobble it up. It makes teaching easy," she said. However, Mike Schreiberg sees a problem with all the attention Fiona has been receiving. Schreiberg is with the National Wildlife Federation, a private nonprofit group. He says environmental activists see all the stories about media stars like Fiona as an avoidance of the serious difficulties hippos and other animals face. These include shrinking wildlife habitats and illegal hunting. Schreiberg argues there is a deeper message about the environment that educators should be sharing. But he admits that, growing up as a child in Cincinnati, he visited the zoo often. He says this helped influence him to become an environmental activist. Schreiberg says the attention on Fiona, which has seen her image placed on items from playing cards to alcoholic drinks, is a good thing overall. We are in favor of anything that is engaging people with wildlife, he said. You've got the American public and people around the world really caring about hippos and animals. I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Enberg. History is usually a process of slow change. However, certain events also can change the course of history. Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo was such an event. So was the first airplane flight by the Wright brothers, or the meeting between the Spanish explorer Cortez and the Aztec king Montezuma. All these events were moments that changed history. And so it was, too, with the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941.
We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air, President Roosevelt has just announced. The attack also was made on all naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu.
We take you now to Washington.
The details are not available. They will be in a few minutes. The White House is now giving out a statement. The attack apparently was made on all naval and on naval and military activities on the principal island of Oahu. The president's brief statement was read to reporters by Stephen Early, the president's secretary. A Japanese attack upon Pearl Harbor naturally would mean war. Such an attack would naturally bring a counterattack, and hostilities of this kind would naturally mean that the president would ask Congress for a declaration of war.
The surprise attack on America's large naval base in Hawaii was a great military success for Japan. However, the attack on Pearl Harbor had more than a military meaning. The attack would force Americans to enter World War II. More importantly, it would also make them better recognize their position as one of the most powerful nations in the world. In future weeks, we will discuss the military and political events of World War II. But today we look back at the years before the United States entered that war. The period between the end of World War I and the attack on Pearl Harbor lasted only 23 years, from 1918 to 1941. But those years were filled with important changes in American politics, culture, and traditions. We start our review of these years with politics. In 1920, Americans elected Republican Warren Harding to the presidency. The voters were tired of the progressive policies of Democratic President Woodrow Wilson. They were especially tired of Wilson's desire for the United States to play an active role in the new League of Nations. Harding was a conservative Republican, and so were the two presidents who followed him, Calvin Coolidge and Herbert Hoover. All three of these presidents generally followed conservative economic policies, and they did not take an active part in world affairs. Americans turned away from Republican rule in the election of 1932. They elected the Democratic presidential candidate, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and they continued to re-elect him. In this way, the conservative Republican policies of the 1920s changed to the more progressive policies of Roosevelt in the 1930s. The change happened mainly because of economic troubles.
So keep cool, and keep Coolidge is the slogan of today.
The 1920s were a time of growth and business strength. President Calvin Coolidge said during his term that the chief business of the American people is business. This generally was the same belief of the other Republican presidents during the period, Warren Harding and Herbert Hoover. There was a good reason for this. The economy expanded greatly during the 1920s. Many Americans made a great deal of money on the stock market, and wages for workers increased as well. However, economic growth ended suddenly with the stock market crash of October 1929. In that month, the stocks for many leading companies fell sharply, and they continued to fall in the months that followed. Many Americans lost great amounts of money, and the public at large lost faith in the economy. Soon, the economy was in ruins, and businesses were closing their doors. President Hoover tried to solve the crisis, but he was not willing to take the strong actions that were needed to end it. As time passed, many Americans began to blame Hoover for the terrible economic depression. Democrat Franklin Roosevelt was elected mainly because he promised to try new solutions to end the Great Depression.
This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive and will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed effort to convert retreat into advance.
Soon after he was elected, Roosevelt launched a number of imaginative economic policies to solve the crisis.
Our greatest primary task is to put people to work. This is no unsolvable problem if we face it wisely and courageously. It can be accomplished in part by direct recruiting by the government itself, treating the task as we would treat the emergency of a war, but at the same time, through this employment, accomplishing greatly needed projects to stimulate and reorganize the use of our great natural resources. Hand in hand with that, we must frankly recognize the overbalance of population in our industrial centers, and by engaging on a national scale in a redistribution, endeavor to provide a better use of the land for those best fitted for the land. Yes, the task can be helped by definite efforts to raise the values of agricultural products, and with this the power to purchase the output of our cities. It can be helped by preventing realistically the tragedy of the growing loss through foreclosure of our small homes and our farms. It can be helped by insistence that the federal, the state, and the local governments act forthwith on the demand that their cost be drastically reduced.
Roosevelt's policies helped to reduce the amount of human suffering. But the Great Depression finally ended only with America's entry into World War II. Roosevelt's victory in 1932 also helped change the balance of power in American politics. Roosevelt brought new kinds of Americans to positions of power: labor union leaders, Roman Catholics, Jews, blacks, Americans from families that had come from places such as Italy, Ireland, and Russia. These Americans repaid Roosevelt by giving the Democratic Party their votes.
The 1920s and 30s also brought basic changes in how Americans dealt with many of their social and economic problems. The 1920s generally were a period of economic growth with little government intervention in the day-to-day lives of the people. But the terrible conditions of the Great Depression during the 1930s forced Roosevelt and the federal government to experiment with new policies. The government began to take an active role in offering relief to the poor. It started programs to give food and money to poor people, and it created jobs for workers. The government grew in other ways. It created major programs for farmers. It set regulations for the stock market. It built dams, roads, and airports. American government looked much different at the end of this period between the World Wars than it did at the beginning. Government had become larger and more important. It dealt with many more issues in people's lives than it ever had before. Social protest increased during the 1920s and 30s. Some black Americans began to speak out more actively about unfair laws and customs. Blacks in great numbers moved from the southern part of the country to northern and central cities. The 1920s and 30s also were a time of change for women. Women began to wear less conservative kinds of clothes. Washing machines and other inventions allowed them to spend less time doing housework. Women could smoke or drink in public, at least in large cities, and many women held jobs. Of course, the women's movement was not new. Long years of work by such women's leaders as Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony had helped women win the constitutional right to vote in 1920. The 1920s and 30s also were important periods in the arts. George Gershwin wrote his Rhapsody in Blue, originally for piano and jazz band. It later went on to become a symphony concert favorite. Writers like Ernest Hemingway, William Faulkner, Eugene O'Neill, and others made this what many called the golden age of American writing. Frank Lloyd Wright and other architects designed great buildings for American cities. Film actors like Clark Gable and radio entertainers like Jack Benny did more than make Americans laugh or cry. They also helped unite the country. Millions of Americans could watch or listen to the same show at the same time. Politics, the economy, social traditions, art. All these changed for Americans during the 1920s and 30s. And many of these changes also had effects in countries beyond America's borders. However, the change that had the most meaning for the rest of the world was the change produced by the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. America's modern history as a great superpower begins with its reaction to that attack. It was a sudden event in the flow of history. It was a day on which a young land suddenly became fully grown.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow for another VOA Learning English program on the Voice of America. And find more stories as well as activities and videos on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. www.voiceofamerica.com.